Well, welcome to another live edition of Investing Simplified here in Portland, Oregon. A beautiful day. In studio with me is co-host Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Carl. And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA Firm. And we're all set for a roaring hour. We like to call it the fastest hour on radio. And we're going to give you a lot of information. But one of the key things about the information we do provide to you and for you is the fact that we're here to answer questions if you have a question. And really, you're a big part of this show. You need to give us a call and ask your question, and we'll give you an answer right here on the air live. You can call us at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Or toll free for you people in the outlying areas, 1-800-990-0750. That's 1-800-990-0750. We've gotten calls from the coast. We've got calls from south. We've got calls from north. And we've got calls from the central Oregon area. So give us a call if you have a question. We're here to answer your question. I'm going to give you some real hard-hitting things here right off the bat about the market and what I think is going to be happening here in the near future, but I'm not going to base it based on what I'm saying. I'm going to take Harry Dent's latest information. He sent out his top five forecasts, I want to just give a little alert here to you. If you're a little edgy on the market, if you're a little concerned about what's going on in the economy, I would highly recommend that either you or anybody you know that is edgy about the market or concerned about the market, give us a call and do a free financial checkup. Because if you don't have your serious money in a strategy that is designed to protect you from the downside of the market, you are making a monumental mistake over the next 5 to 7 years, and maybe as long as 9. So I really recommend that you take advantage of it and get together on your serious money. We don't have to manage all your money, but your serious money, you need to take a look at that and make sure you have it in a place. And, you know, I could give the stock market report, but I've been giving it on the air. And if you do want to know it, you can always get a hold of me, and I'll give you the numbers on that. But right now, I'm just going to give the Harry Dent's top five predictions. Number one. I almost got a drum roll there. But number one, stock market crash will begin soon. Since the early top, the 2000, I've been saying for a long time, I felt that the market changed in 99, the entire world of the economy. And I think we're more on a world economy than we are on an American economy, because most of the American stock companies are no longer American stock companies. They're worldwide companies. So we're kind of going by the way the world goes. But Harry's predicting that we're going to have a crash in the market. It's going to happen soon. He looks for the Dow to fall as much as 5,000 points over the next 2 to 3 years, and then something like 10,000 into 2017, and that will likely see the ultimate bottom of 3,300 by 2020. So if you just listen to that right now, the question I have for you listeners out there is, do you have a strategy to protect you if that happens? Now, you know, nobody knows for sure it's going to happen, and Harry's given predictions in the past. He's been pretty close. He's given them out long term, but nobody can pick the day. We just can't pick that day. So you need to be ready. You need to have a plan, and you need to have a strategy. But I really believe it's going to happen. The second one that I really kind of like, and any of us who drive. Any of us who drive and have to use our car is going to like this one. Oil prices will hit $45 a barrel by 2016.
I'm keeping my pickup truck.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hey, listen, those big gas hogs might not be all bad, huh? Price of gas is going to go down.
I thought you were going to say $45 a gallon.
No, it's
okay,
going down,
barrel,
going down. This is positive, not negative. Okay. You know, hey, listen, in every economic situation, just like the Great Depression, there were a lot of millionaires created because they had the cash to make some really good deals and buy property for pennies on the dollar and buy companies for pennies on the dollar. That same thing is going to happen again. You're going to have a great opportunity. Number three, gold prices will continue to plunge. So all you gold mites out there, and I've been saying for years, you know, if you want to have 3 to 5% in precious metals, that's fine. Right now, if I were going to tell somebody to do precious metals, it'd be silver, not gold. And we could discuss that at a later time, but that's kind of the way I look at it. I think gold is going to go down and going to continue to go down. And one of the things you look at the market, historically, gold, when the market goes up and down, gold has went the other way. Gold recently has been going the same way. So I think when the market plunges, gold's going to plunge as well. Number four, U.S. dollar will keep rising. Contrary to popular belief, everybody on the news, all they tell you on the news is that nobody likes America and, you know, we're the bad guy and all that other crap. The reality is this. The reality is this. From an economic standpoint, when push comes to shove, foreign countries bring their money to America and put their money in America. We are the land of opportunity. We always have been. We always will be. And people, when things get bad, they'll bring their money to our shores. That's just a reality of life. Number five, and this is one I've been talking about on this show for a long time, and I know nobody wants to hear this, but real estate is set for another crash. The second bubble's coming. The crash is going to happen. And look, mortgage applications for purchases continue to be flat. Mortgage rates are rising. I see home prices falling another 34 to 44% between now and 2016. 2016, folks, is about a year and a half away. And if you're not getting your house in order and being prepared for this kind of thing to happen, it's going to catch you by surprise. We hope on this show we give you some ideas so that it doesn't catch you by surprise. But I'm going to tell you right now, if you don't have a strategy, and if you know anybody who's got a large portfolio and they don't have a strategy, they need to pick up the phone, call me at the office, come in, do a free financial review. I won't, you know, hound them or anything. I'll just tell them the facts. I'll show them the facts. And most people, when they look at the historical market fluctuation and they look at what's coming, they want to have a strategy to protect their assets. And if you don't have one, you're going to be in a lot worse shape than the person who does. So my recommendation is develop a strategy. I met with a person the other day in the market and who came in the office, and they had actually, this particular person was a fairly young person. She had got a rollover from her previous company, and she happened to drive by her office, saw her sign, came in, and I sat down, I talked to her about it, and she came in, and the bank, and I, you know, I'm not a real advocate of banks. Sometimes banks do the right thing, sometimes they don't. I think some of the fines that have been handed out to banks recently have been a little unfair, because the banks had to follow the regulations the federal government set for them, and then when they followed them, then they turned around and got fined for it. So, you know, the government has some cooperability here. The other thing I don't understand is all these fines are given to the banks. Why isn't that money going back to the individual homeowner? That just drives me nuts. They've collected almost $40 billion in fines. And how much of that's going to the individual person? But anyway, I digress. Let's get back to this gal. She came back in and she had went to a bank, and I won't mention the name of it. I won't even give the initials. But the advisor there, the person at the bank, this gal happened to be in her early 40s, they recommended a mutual fund for her, and they only showed her the last 5 years of the mutual fund. So I proceeded to pull up my screen and show her what that mutual fund had actually done over the last 14 years. It's not even back to where it was in 2000. And I said to her, now, you know, you got time. You got 25 years to go to build this money up. But do you really want your money growing at this rate over the next 14 years? I mean, you look at the graph, and it's the graph. But what really shocked me was, and this is one of the things I talk about in my book that we need to change, the way advisors are allowed to show people funds. I have to tell you, I have people coming in all the time to show me a fund, and one that that is well-known fund. I won't mention the name here, although I really lay it out in my book and I show you the truth of the fund in my book, and you'll have to get the book to read it to see. But I talk about how this fund is sold as an income fund by a lot of people, and it is talked about low fees. Well, you know what? Low fees are great if you make money. They kind of suck if you lose money every single year, or if you lose money over, you know, 11 years out of 14 years you're playing catch-up. I don't think that's the way you want to invest. So what I always suggest to people is if you're looking at a fund or you're looking at an investment, ask to see the five best years of the fund and the five worst years of the fund. Not the average annual return. I've talked on this show a lot about average annual return. Average annual return means nothing. It's not a true number. The number you want to look for is real rate of return. This particular fund, when I got through showing her that it wasn't making 14%, yeah, it made 14% if you invested at the bottom of the market. And I'm almost embarrassed to say, as a licensed representative, that the advisor only showed her the five-year track record. I mean, I don't think his compliance officer or the compliance officer at that bank would be overly happy if this gal went and bought this 14% fund and ended up losing money the next 5 years.
Well, you've talked on prior shows about fiduciary duty, and it sounds to me like somebody working for a bank or a brokerage firm, if I remember correctly, their fiduciary duty is actually to that company and not to the investor. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's one of the things you need to be asking the advisor you're talking to is, what is your fiduciary accountability? Is it to me? Is it to your employer? Is it to your broker-dealer? What is your fiduciary responsibility? And I know that we all three, when we work with clients, we all accept a fiduciary accountability with our clients that we're doing the best thing for our client first. May not be the best thing for us, may not be the best thing for our firm, but we're going to do the best thing for the client first. And that's really the fiduciary responsibility. And I got to tell you, with all the myriad of all the funds out there in the world, you know, there's tens of thousands of funds out there. To pick one and to show this person a five-year track record, to me, borders on criminal. It really does. I mean, it's insane. But anyway, if you've got a question, and I hope you do today, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626, or toll-free 800-990-0750. And I want to point you, I'm having some work done on my website, pfgwm.com. I have some new videos on there that are really good videos. I have a gentleman by the name of Rocky DeFrancisco, who is an attorney out of Ohio, who we do some work with on kind of exotic state cases. And Rocky's got some great videos talking about it. He's not a licensed person. He doesn't make anything off of the investments or anything, but he is able to say some things that I can't say. And he says them very eloquently, and he has the facts to back him up, which I like, because being an attorney, I think he has to know those right words. Right, Carl?
It's important for him to be careful about what he says, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's one of the nice things. He can say it, and I just got him on my website. So listen, if you got a question, give us a call. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Carl's comments.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management on the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen, and it is time for Carl's comments. And today we're going to try to talk about, we often talk about living trusts and other kinds of trusts. And today we're going to talk about trustees. And more importantly, I'm going to offer you 12 things a trustee can do to avoid trouble and litigation. Trustee is a, we were just talking about fiduciary relationships, and a trustee is a, by its very nature, is a, has a fiduciary relationship with the beneficiaries of the trust. And that means it's not their money. That means they have to treat the money as is theirs, but not spend it. They have to try to do the best they can for their beneficiaries. And there are some things that get people into trouble, and I've been involved in a lot of litigation about it over the years, and a lot of times it's they're claiming that the trustee charged too much money, or they, you know, used the fund on their own to make kind of loans to themselves and sort of take care of their own needs, treated it like their own private cookie jar. So that's something you don't want to do. But so there are a couple of things I want to do. If you're a new trustee, the first thing that you ought to think about is – probably the first thing we ought to talk about is that there may be a caller on the line.
Yeah, we do. We have a line one, a caller, Russell from Forest Grove. Russell, are you there?
Yes.
And you've got a question?
Yes. Question is, I'm down to one stock that I still own, American Telephone and Telegraph. And it delivers a very large dividend for this time of the world. I just wondered if I ought to hang on to it or sell it.
Well, here's the thing I would say to you is, how long have you had the stock?
No, a few years.
What's your how much are you ahead on your cost basis?
Well, I don't know, but it pays the dividends. Like 5.1% dividends every year, and it's been paying dividends for, I think, 28, 29 years consistently. It raises the dividend.
Well, but here's the key thing is, how long have you owned the stock? And how much gain do you have in the stock? In other words, you know, if you put $10,000 in it, it's worth $50,000 now, you got a nice big gain. Do you have a large amount of capital gain build up in the stock?
A fair amount. not a large amount, no.
Okay, not a large amount. Well, then if you bought it for the dividend, then I would say just and if it's not, you know, if it's not more than 5 to 7% of your portfolio, I'd say hang on to it. You know, if you bought it for the dividend, then hang on to it. What I'm saying on here, and I've been saying on here for some time, if you have stocks and you have a lot of capital gains built up, I recommend doing a stop loss. And here's why, and I'll just give you a real quick example. Let's say you have a stock you bought for $20 a share. That stock is now sitting at $80 a share. I believe the market's overripe. It's going to go back. So I would put a stop loss on that $80 price, maybe at $70 or $75, depending on how much I want to lose of the 80, I'd put a price at 75. When the market drops, you sell that stock at 75. Now, you've kept a $35 gain, right?
Right.
Okay, you got to pay capital gains on that. Capital gains tax right now is very low, one of the lowest tax you can pay. So I'd hang on to that money, and I'd let that stock work down, and maybe you could rebuy the stock. Now, remember, you started at 40. The stock went to 80, you sold out at 75, right?
Right.
So you've got almost twice as much stock as you started with, cash anyway. So the market drops, that stock goes back down again, you can turn around and rebuy the stock. Remember, there's a 30-day rule on buying and selling stock, but it only applies if you take a tax loss, not if you take a capital gain. So you could turn around and let that stock, you sell it at 75, the stock drops down to $30 a share. You think that's a good long-term stock. You turn around and take that money you got for the $75 a share and turn around and buy it all at 30. Not a bad deal. I just think it's a wise strategy right now when we have a lot of volatility in the market.
Okay.
So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it did. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thank you. Good question. Good question there. Carl?
Well, back to the trustee, and we're started on number one, the 12 things that a trustee can do to avoid trouble in litigation. And number one, read the trust. It's not uncommon that people just sort of think that they know what the trust says, or they've only read portions of it. And as a corollary to number one, the second thing is to get some legal help to interpret it, because trusts are complicated sometimes, and they often give a list of many powers that the trustee has. And it's kind of like so many things, trying to read it literally just doesn't quite work that way. You have to remember that there's still this fiduciary relationship. And I've had trustees who basically become, you know, sort of tyrants. They're the king of the trust, and they read the trust to mean that they can, all of those powers means that they get to do that, whatever it says they can do, regardless of what anybody else thinks and regardless of, you know, whether or not it's the best thing to do. And that just simply isn't true. So you have to be cautious about, you know, taking actions as a trustee unless you're really, you know, convinced that it's within the parameters of the trust as it is. And if there's any question, you should seek some legal advice. So number two, review the trustor's paper and mail to discover assets and creditors. Now, this is in the context of you're just taking over a trust either for someone who's become incapacitated or they have been deceased, and you're taking over this to manage the trust for other beneficiaries. Number three, prepare an inventory of the assets. You should have this available to you, and because occasionally you have to report exactly what the assets of the trust might be. Number four, prepare a list of creditors. If the trustor, the person who created the trust, or the trust itself have creditors, you need to make sure that those bills get paid. Make sure that they're legitimate creditors, of course, before doing that. Number five, review existing insurance policies and determine if any additional insurance is necessary for the property that or whatever it is that they insure. Sometimes it's a situation where someone has some real property or maybe some other kinds of assets that the insurance has lapsed, and it may be important to purchase that insurance to make sure that you don't have a loss on those kinds of assets. So number six, this one is often left open, I guess you might say, or undone. Change the ownership of the assets to the trust. In other words, what that really means is, say, for example, that the trust has some brokerage accounts or bank accounts, and they're in the name of the trustee. Well, if you're the new trustee, you got to go over there and get the bank to take care of that for you and put your name on it.
Carl, we got a caller on the line. Carl in Vancouver, you got a question, Carl?
Yes, I do. I appreciate you guys' input. Hey, I got a question about, you guys talk about investments for your kids going to college. Do you guys still think the plan was to be where you put it in for their savings?
Well, you're in Washington, and if you're looking at a college plan in Washington, I think Washington has a superior plan to most companies. And if your child is young and you got time, Washington's program is excellent because you can buy today's dollar. And one of the rising things that just blows the doors off of inflation is college prices. So in Washington, you have a program where you can buy, basically put your money in, buy the college price today, lock that price in today, and have it be the same price down the road. Have those dollars buy the same amount of education down the road in today's dollars. So that's a great deal. And I think inflation and growth like that is going to be is better than any plan I've seen out there.
So you think that's better than doing maybe like a Roth IRA for them? Or what do you think about that?
Well, Kevin, what do you think about a Roth IRA for a college education and the tax liability of that?
So, first off, you have to meet certain parameters to be able to contribute to a Roth. They have to have earnings for a Roth to be set up in a person's name. So, you know, hopefully they've got some sort of work going. They've got some earnings. And so if that's all in place and, you know, you put up to $5,500 into a Roth in their name, they can, you know, that would earn money tax-free. They can, you can always pull the principal out. So it's not a bad thing to do that. You know, I wouldn't probably go all in. My personal opinion is I wouldn't go all in either way. I'd do some of both. Although, like Chuck's saying, that Washington plan's pretty attractive. The Oregon 529 plan is kind of a waste of time.
I mean, even comparable to Washington.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Yeah, you save maybe $300-$400 a year per student.
Kevin, what are the restrictions tax wise? I mean, you got to keep the Roth for 5 years, and is there any requirement in taking out prior to 59.5?
You can, and I will confirm this, but I believe you can take up to you can take out money for higher education costs. So in other words, you can take out earnings. You can always take your principal out tax free anytime, even before the 5 years. After that, the earnings you can pull out for higher ed costs and not pay the 10% penalty. I believe you won't pay income tax on that either. So it is a vehicle that could be used correctly.
I think the key there, though, Carl, is that you'd have to be very careful about the investment you're putting in right now. How long do you have for the children before they hit college?
Well, I got two kids. I got the third one. Obviously, he can't be in it because he's 20 years old. But the other two are boys, and they're 13 and 11.
Okay, so you've got, for the 11-year-old, you got maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I would really recommend during that time period what we think is going to be happening in the economy. I would be very, very cautious about the investment because investments by nature, when people talk about mutual funds, they talk about mutual funds for 529 plans. The problem I got with that is anybody will tell you if you're going to keep a mutual fund, you got to keep it at least 10 years. So your longest time is 7 or 8 years.
So yes, my time is real short. I know.
Yeah. So you're really limited.
My wallet tells me that too.
Yeah. Yep. You're limited.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately. So I really think being in Washington, your best bet is to go at least 50% or 60% into that Washington plan, and if you want to put some money into a Roth. But I really like the Washington plan. If your kids are going to stay in Washington, if they're going to go to school in the state of Washington, it is a slam dunk deal.
Okay, that's another thing to bring up. Now, if they don't go to school in Washington, so they go to another state, does that make a difference too? Well, or will that make a difference?
It does on the Washington plan. Washington plan is all designed for educational cost in the state of Washington. So
yeah, so that's got some parameters to it too. So
yeah. But again, when you look at the cost of college, I mean, you know, at some point, unless you've got unlimited income and unlimited sources, your kids may have to consider the fact that if you got three of them to put through school, they may want to go to Washington colleges. So part of that is taken care of.
So that's a good idea, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I know what college costs. I used to work at one. I used to work at a private college in Oregon, and then the cost of the college there, and that's an undergrad thing, and it was like $50,000 a year.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's not going any lower anytime
soon.
Yeah.
No, it keeps crawling up there.
Yeah, really, really good question, Carl. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for your help, guys. I always appreciate your help.
Great question.
Bye-bye.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to get back to our other Carl.
Well, Carl's back. anyway, changing the ownership of trust assets, really that's an administrative function. You really need to go to the financial institutions and change the name of the account to you. So, and also so that the bank or the financial institution recognizes you as the person who is now the trustee. They'll ask you for your documentation that shows that you are the new trustee and, you know, verify your identity and bona fides. So then number 7, you have to invest trust assets prudently. And there's a whole bunch of stuff about this in the law, but basically what I would recommend, unless you happen to be a like Chuck, you really need to hire somebody like Chuck. You need somebody that can give you good investment advice. That's a good insulation. You know, you're not going to have too many people complain if you have a reputable financial advisor advise you on how to invest the trust. And I tend to think that in a trust situation, you're going to be looking primarily at you know, wealth preservation as opposed to growth. You the last thing on earth you want to have is the principal of that trust to fall off the tracks. It's better to run out of money by doing it in a conservative way than it is to, you know, make a lot of money and then have it all fall out the bottom drawer. So anyway, just a thought as a trustee. Nobody ever blames you for making a little bit of money. They blame you for not, you know, for losing a bunch of money. So anyway, you need number eight. You need to keep records very carefully because eventually you're going to be called to account for this thing. That's financial expenses. Keep memos. Keep a journal. Keep it in QuickBooks or hire a bookkeeper. Whatever you got to do, but make sure that you have all of the records, that everything goes in and everything that goes out's got to be shown on that on your record keeping. Number nine, never, ever commingle your money with the trust money. You don't want to put it together or take it out together or put it, you know, use the trust money and then, you know, reimburse the trust for stuff. Just that, you just don't want to do that. You want to have a trail of records that goes from the trust to the trust and never anywhere else. So, number 10, file the required tax returns. And again, you need some professional help to do this because, excuse me, it can be a challenging a business, especially if you have to start with an inheritance tax return or a state tax return. And most trusts require a fiduciary tax return on an annual basis and income tax return, and it's not the kind of thing that most people see. They're a little different, because you want to make sure that interest or the income is imputed to the right beneficiary, as it usually is, but you don't want the trust really paying income tax if you can help it, because it's at a much higher rate than an individual rate. So number 11, get professional help. I got that. That was number 11. So I blended them together. And finally, number 12, keep the beneficiaries informed. Let them know what's going on. One of the first thing that you need to do is establish good communication with your beneficiaries, because if you don't have that, I can't tell you how many litigation cases have been started against a trustee because they're hiding the ball. And this goes back to, you know, sometimes the way that they read the trust, where they say, it's none of your darn business. I'm doing whatever I want. I'm the trustee, and I'm, you know, I'll tell you. Well, guess what? The court will come back and say, no, you don't. You got to talk to these beneficiaries. It's really their money. You have to let them know what you're doing. And so hopefully those things are helpful to you. And those are 12 things that if all trustees followed them, I think there would be, you know, no problems with trusts ever. The number one is, it's not your money. Don't steal it.
Unfortunately, human nature steps in there sometimes.
We'd be amazed at the justifications that people have for, you know, the little, oh, well, you know, I had to remodel my house because, you know, the beneficiary was going to come to live with me. Well, you know, they built a 3,000 foot, addition to the house, and mom's 90 years old. She's not going to live for more than 3 years. That's not going to cut it. So anyway, it's not your money.
That's great. Well, listen, if you've got a question, give us a call, 503-417-7626. Our toll-free 800-990-0750. Going to take a quick break here and come back with the tax investigator.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified. We've had some good calls, callers calling in, and we want to keep that up. So if you have a question on your mind, give us a call, 503-417-7626 or 800-990-0750. And we would like to hear from you and see what you're planning, what you're thinking, and see if we can be of help. Back to what our previous caller, Carl from Vancouver, had to say. You know, as I've kind of molded over here, you know, the Roth is, you know, for educational purposes, isn't a bad idea in his particular situation. If he were to be fairly conservative in a Roth investing, you know, that would kind of protect his investment there, or at least the kid's investment. You know, and again, you can always pull that principal out for any purpose, and then the earnings could be used for higher education purposes. One of the drawbacks to the Roth would be, generally, you can't deduct a loss in a Roth. And so if you were into something not so conservative, and if it gets hit, that's just a lost loss, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the thing I was concerned about for him was the short period of time here. Boy, this is a real danger zone to try to invest in a risk product over a 5 to 8 year period of time. You're just playing Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm. And I said generally you can't deduct a loss in a Roth because actually you can if you follow a real set of rules where you've liquidated all of your Roth accounts and your liquidation is less than your basis that you got into it. Then you do get a certain loss that you can put on your tax return, but a kid is not going to be itemizing his deductions. It's not going to benefit him. So it's going to be a lost loss.
Well, if he had the income, you know, with the three kids, and if him and his wife, if all five of them could do Roth, you know, if they could afford to do that, that'd be a lot of money.
Yeah, $5,500. A piece, or $6,500 if they're over 50.
Right, and so if you have five of them, you know, you got over $30,000 a year going in, real close to $30,000 a year going in, and if he's got 5 to 7 years, that'd be $150,000, $200,000 bucks if they didn't make any interest. So you take a look at that. That might not be a bad opportunity to do, but the question would be, and the problem I would have is, where would you put that money for that short period of time and make a return without risking the principal? That'd be a tough shot.
Exactly. At 1% CD rates, that's not real exciting for all the shenanigans.
Yeah, 1%. I don't know where you're going to get 1% at, but yeah.
That's right. Well, you know, last week we talked about a brief court case where an individual had a right to an inheritance. Disclaimed that right so that the IRS couldn't get their fingers on it because he owed a large tax bill. And the tax court said, no, you had a right to it, so the IRS has a right to slap the lien on there and take collection of it. Well, following along the same train of thought, we have another court case, or actually it's more of a chief counsel advice. These are tax technical terms. You don't want to know the methods they get to these things, but this is a chief counsel advice, and it's related to something that I had not heard of. It's called and I want to see if you guys have heard of this. Do you know what a voluntary exclusion program is? And I'm hoping you don't. Okay. Good.
Carl might.
No, it sounds almost like, you know, like belonging to a private country club or something, you know, I don't know.
Okay, I'm glad you guys don't. This is a program that states use for gambling addicts. And
if, well, that's a good reason why we don't know, because Carl and I don't gamble.
That's what I was hoping about. Yeah. Okay. I figured maybe Carl maybe brushed into it on his legal side, but I figured that's not a good thing for a financial advisor
we
to
don't,
know
yeah.
about. So a voluntary exclusion program is where somebody is in a gambling recovery program, and they sign a contract, a legally binding contract, that says if they ever enter a state casino, and if they ever win, they do not get to collect the winnings. In other words, there's no benefit to them gambling in a state casino. They cannot win money. And so their name goes on a list, their description goes on a list, this program gets distributed to the state casinos. I don't know if Oregon has one of these or not, but some states do.
So what you're saying is the guy goes into the casino, he owes the state $100,000 in back taxes, or he has a debt against the state?
This has nothing to do with any tax debt. This is just gambling addiction counseling, and it's basically giving him the incentive not to gamble because he has nothing to gain.
So this is the breathalyzer for the car guy that drives the car who's a drunk, and this is the same kind of protection for the guy that goes in the gambling casino.
I think so.
It's the no gamble list.
I like it. I like it.
That's exactly what it is.
I think they need this. This sounds really good to me.
Yeah, so this has been in effect for a while. And so basically, if they do, and they're actually prohibited from going into state casinos, but if they do go in, you know, the legal side is that they can be arrested for trespassing. But if they do go in, they do sit down, they do hit a jackpot, supposedly when they provide their ID, their name's on the list, they won't get paid.
But it's okay if they go in and lose.
You're pushing.
I'm sorry to throw a wrench in this, but it's okay if they lose, but it's not okay if they win.
Well, that's a disincentive to gamble in the first place.
They can't
possibly win, and they can't lose. That's really, you know, a double whammy.
That's a lose-lose.
The other question is, who gets the money that they do win if they violate this thing?
Actually, I do know that. That's in this. In the article. But that's not the point of this. Okay, so if they do win and they're denied the winnings, the winnings go into a fund to help gambling addiction. So it continues to go into the fund, and you know, I guess if somebody wins big, the fund gets paid big. So, but the question remains: does this individual who has done this, does this individual have to report the income on their tax return?
And they don't get the income?
And they don't get the income. This is along the same lines as the estate.
Well,
I
would say if it's logical, no, they wouldn't, but it's probably not logical, so they probably do.
I'm voting with Chuck. No.
Yeah. And that's right. They do. And there is some common sense and some
Believe it.
Some rules in our tax system. Assignment of income. He does not have to report the income on his tax return because he legally did not have a right to that income. It's not like he disclaimed it afterwards. Beforehand, he didn't have a right to the income.
Well, it's kind of like in my business, we have a thing called constructive receipt. Where if you accept the money and you got the money, then you got it, baby. And so as long as you don't accept constructive receipt, you never receive the money, the proceeds.
Yep.
It's not a taxable event.
Exactly. So even if he is arrested, at least he doesn't have a tax hit.
Nope, maybe bail bonds.
Exactly. Well, speaking of tax hits, the taxpayers are getting tax hit again, and maybe, you know, we briefly talked about this a little bit, but Bank of America had a record almost $17 billion fine levied against them. And what's interesting is this brings up the topic of how much of that do they get to deduct on their tax return.
Well, Kevin, not only was that bad at $17 billion, that is all the profits they made over the last 3 years.
That's pretty steep.
Pretty steep. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say so. So do they get to write that off?
Well, under the terms of the settlement, $5 billion of it is considered a fine. And you do not get to deduct fines and penalties on your tax return. But that leaves them the ability to deduct $12 billion on their tax return. So about, you know, assuming a 33% corporate tax rate or so, about $4 billion of that is going to be paid by the taxpayers against their income. Of course, you were saying that they had no income their last 3 years because of this. So
yeah,
so,
they just wiped out 3 years of income. And the other thing is, does it say in there how when the government takes this money, where's this money go? Does it say there where it goes?
It doesn't.
Yeah,
I think most of it goes to the federal government. I don't believe, you know, I think some of it does go to specific homeowners and stuff, but I you know, maybe Carl's got some insight on that, but I don't know exactly where it goes.
I've been trying to find that, looking at different articles on it, and I haven't found anywhere except that it goes to different departments of the federal government. And so I'm not sure there's a system set up to give it back to the individual homeowner, but my gosh, the individual homeowner is the one who took the brunt of this whole thing.
The almighty government, that's right.
Yeah.
So in these agreements, when they're getting, when these companies are getting fined, you know, the Swiss companies are getting fined for hiding U.S. taxpayers' names that are hiding money overseas and stuff, and they're getting big fines, you know, to because of what they did and stuff. They're structuring these agreements to allow at least portions or a large portion of it to be deductible in their tax returns. And the difference is, just like you and me, if we're driving for our small business and we get a speeding ticket, the company pays for the speeding ticket, but it's not deductible on the company's tax return. It's a fine or a penalty. A parking ticket, same thing. And in this case, it would be the same thing. A fine or a penalty is not deductible. But if the settlement is structured as remedial, and that's the key thing, is, and when they make these Carl's got a Cheshire cat grin on his face. He loves these word games. If it's considered remedial, then it's not a fine or a penalty and it becomes deductible. And so when they structure these agreements, they make sure that the verbiage is in there saying exactly what dollar amount is a fine and a penalty, which they negotiate as low as possible, and what dollar amount is remedial. And of course, who knows how much of that is actually remedial.
Yeah, I thought Carl's eyes kind of lit up and thinking about litigate and prosper.
Yeah, yeah, well, remedial means they got to raise their hand and say, I won't do it again, honest.
That's it, huh? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's great. Well, listen, if you've got a question or you got a call, give us a call at 503-417-7626 or toll-free 800-990-0750. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust. You're listening to Investing Simplified. That was a good thing.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
My name is Monty.
Well, this is the segment where we open up the lines and recommend you give us a call. We've got about 6-7 minutes left in the program. If you call us at 503-417-7626 or toll-free 800-990-0750. And we can also talk about some things that, you know, that's going on in our businesses. And one of the things I think is real important here, Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you if they need to get a hold of you?
We're at bakercolson.com, and our address is 2414 Northeast Division Street in Gresham. And you can email me at kstege, K-S-T-E-E-G-E, at baker-colson.com.
And one thing I'll say about Kevin's office, they have a ton of CPAs, and so far I've encountered a couple of clients who have had assets come down from Canada and other parts of the world, and one of the nice things about being able to contact Kevin is he can find somebody in his office that can take care of those kind of things, and that's really nice to have that advantage, so that's a great thing to have. Carl, how can we get a hold of you?
Warren Allen's located at 850 Northeast 122nd. That's very close to the Gleason on-ramp of the off of 205. Telephone number is 503-255-8795. I can be reached at Jepsen, J-E-P-S-E-N, at warrenallen.com. That's W-A-R-R-E-N-A-L-L-E-N.com. And warrenallen.com on the web. And likewise, we have 9 attorneys, and so we cover a huge variety of legal areas for any individual or small business. So give us a call.
Yeah, we've referred several people over to your office with your real estate people. You have some people in your office that are excellent at real estate and real estate problems and concerns, and that is very helpful.
You bet. Yeah, we cover a bunch of stuff: real estate, corporate stuff, family law, personal injury.
Yeah.
Litigation. You bet.
Well, and Carl does an excellent job on estate planning. And one of the things I'll say about estate planning is, we recently encountered a situation that we're working on an estate case that's going to actually end up having to pay some estate taxes. And one of the pitches I'm going to give here, I talked about the market and I talked about taking care of your investments and stuff, but I really got to emphasize to you, if you have an estate over $1 million in the state of Oregon and you don't do some planning, you really need to. You can save your heirs hundreds of thousands of dollars by doing planning before something happens. And, sometimes it's hard. And the older we get, the less we want to take care of those things. And it really should be the opposite. The older we get, the sooner we need to get them taken care of, because we don't know. None of us knows.
Well, and it is a little bit of a chore. I mean, it's not, if it were really, really simple, everybody would, do it themselves. And there are some things, there are some homework that has to be done on the part of the clients. They have to, visit their financial institutions and fill out some forms and go over the forms with us and fill out and sign a lot of stuff. And there's a fair amount of work to it. And so it's not an easy process necessarily, but I believe that most of my clients feel good about what they've done after they've done it, because it makes them feel as though their affairs are in order.
Just a little quick follow-up here. We had a caller this morning call in and talked about AT&T stock, and I just happened to pull up the stock, and this is for the gentleman that called in asking about the stock. And one of the things I'd say is if you bought that stock back in 2000, you're down about 40% on that stock, and so you actually have a tax loss. And so really, on the amount of money you put into that stock, that dividend return right now is 5.2% on the stock. That's assuming you got full value for your stock price. And so this person would actually have about a 2.5% return, because their stock would be down. So that's the thing you want to look at. I'd definitely put a stop loss on that, and protect whatever gains you do have, if you have gains. But if you have tax losses, that's a little different story there. Then you might just hang on to it for the dividend. But listen, any other closing comments? We've got just a couple minutes here. Not enough time for a call, but...
Well, you had mentioned earlier about your book. How does somebody get a copy of your book?
Well, on October 14th is the release date. It'll be released the 14th, but people can go online at askthefinancialdoctor.com, and you can pre-order it. We have a pre-sale going right now and about a $3 discount if you want to pre-order it before it comes out. But it's going through all the stuff that we got to go through. I'm using a financial company out of North Carolina that does financial books. I want to make sure everything I have in there I can back up and, what's that word, Carl?
plausible deniability.
There you go. That's it. That's it. I want to be able to. I want to be able to say that, and I'm going to always say that Carl said it was okay. So I just ask my attorney. Don't ask me. But we hope to have that done, and it'll also be linked on our pfgwm.com. And I do want to reemphasize again on there. You can go on there. We don't have the link yet set up for the Harry Dent Economy and Markets. Got to get the right name of it. They changed the name of their little daily newsletter. It's called Economy and Markets. And if you haven't signed up for that yet, you can go on my site and do it, or you can go on to hsdent.com and sign up for it. And I highly recommend it because there's a lot of information on there that you really want to have. Want to give two shout-outs, one to the Mariners. What a great job. Come back, score 5 runs in the 9th inning to beat the Boston Red Sox. And the Seahawks just keep rolling. Not next week, but the following week, we will give our Super Bowl predictions. And I do want to admit that I hit mine right on the nail last year.
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I haven't even seen them play yet, but I'm still going for the Bills.
I think you got a tough climb, buddy. I'm going to still go for the Seahawks. We'll be back in next week is Labor Day weekend. Have a great Labor Day weekend. We'll have a replay on our show, but we'll be back the following week to answer your questions and your calls. You can always email us at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Have a great weekend.
We do investing simplified.